Hello, everybody. Welcome back to Paddock Project. Happy summer break. I hope you are really enjoying the time. I miss F1, I will say, but I am actually so happy to have a little bit of a reset. It seems like all the drivers seem to be enjoying themselves and doing a lot of different things, mostly involving yachts and oceans and things like that. But I loved the update pictures that Lewis dropped this past week with Roscoe, and him touching grass somewhere was a very nice update and was glad to see it. I'm super excited for F1 to come back because the next race that is happening is one I will be at. I am heading to Zandvoort for the Dutch Grand Prix. I am so excited. I've never been before. If you have tips, please DM me. Please message me. Send them my way. Have a lot of fun things planned and going to see lots of fun friends and people around. And of course, F1 Academy will be there as well. So lots of exciting stuff to come. And as I mentioned in a previous episode, I have relocated to France. I'm getting married in September in France, so I'm living and working from Paris for the next month or so, which has been incredible, and I have been enjoying the break. And so speaking of break, I am going to be running a rerun episode today. There's no sort of net new episode because I think we all deserve a little bit of a summer break. And I was going through my camera roll and looking through all the videos I had taken in Monaco earlier this year when I went to the race. I was seeing all these DHL trucks. I was seeing all the team trucks. I was thinking a lot about logistics. And I did post a reel on Instagram sort of talking about the behind the scenes European summer logistics because it's a little bit of a unique beast. And it got me thinking about the interview we did last year with DHL's head of motorsports. And I really wanted to run that one back because I think it's one of the coolest parts of Formula One. And if you were not listening last year or somehow you missed it, or even if you did listen to it and want a refresher, I think it's one of the coolest episodes that gives you a behind the scenes look at how the Formula One circus actually operates. So I'm going to be rolling that one today in lieu of a new episode, but I wanted to just hop on beforehand and say hello. Hope everybody is doing well. And I'm excited for racing to come back. But in the meantime, please enjoy this and take some time for yourselves, off your phones, off your TV screens, and just enjoy. Hello, everybody. Welcome to For the World, our monthly sustainability series. Today, we are beyond honored to have Paul Fowler, DHL's head of global motorsports logistics, and Giorgia Tirabassi, DHL's trackside operations manager, with us today. So DHL has been running motorsport logistics for 4 decades and has been F1's official logistics partner for the past 20 years, which is the longest standing partnership in F1 history. And I don't think it's a stretch to say that F1 is probably the most logistically complex sport. So you both have massive jobs. And given that complexity and scale, logistics is one of the most important things when it comes to making it all happen over a given weekend, as well as sustainability and the push towards net zero for F1. So, Paul, you've been in the industry for almost 4 decades. Giorgia, you've also had so many years of experience and have been to every race around the world. So we cannot wait to discuss. I think maybe to set the stage, it would be great if you both could tell us briefly, in your words, what DHL does for Formula One and where your roles come in that.
Okay, I can lead. My responsibility is, as you said, I'm Vice President for Global Motorsport for DHL. So we've been proud partners for 40 years, as you mentioned. I've been around for 37 of them. So it is a calling. It's a real career, not a job. And we're charged with the responsibility of moving everything, lock, stock and barrel for 24, going probably to 25. Events globally. I've seen the series grow massively since I've been involved. So when I started, it was 4 international races. There was the European, now it's 14. So you can see the growth.
Wow. 25 races makes our skin crawl. I can imagine what it does for you.
Yeah, no, it's, as I say, it's a calling.
Yeah, well, I am operations manager. Again, I have been in the industry for 6 years. So yeah, I have seen a little bit. It has changed anyway from 2018, but it still is enjoyable. So until then, it's fine.
Well, maybe you have 40 years in you, just like Paul.
Yeah, and we'll be a race every day of the year.
She's a natural. Trust me, she's a natural.
So like Tiggy said, DHL is doing a huge amount of work for every race weekend. We read somewhere that you transport 1,400 tons of trait to every race weekend from the cars all the way down to Paddock Club cutlery. So I think the real question is, what does DHL not transport to races?
We basically do the whole show. We don't move the people, obviously. and there's a huge traveling circus that makes this whole event happen. I have to say, I have to dedicate a lot to my team. They are on the road all the time, ensuring, you know, the receipt of the cargo, the sending of the cargo. So we have multiple teams, especially with the back-to-backs, etc. So in terms of the show, from fuel to tires to the cars, the equipment to TV broadcast, everything that makes it happen locally as well as internationally is utilized in sea, road or air.
Wow. That's wild, and so many different channels and mediums, sea, road, and air, which we definitely are excited to chat about. But I'm curious, how much is pre-planned before the season starts versus adjusting each race or sort of on the fly? I imagine you would like to get most things pre-planned, but I imagine it doesn't always happen like that.
Yeah, over the last few years, it's changed a lot. We're normally extremely proactive in terms of 80% is planned, and there's always things that change, but with the world we're in now, with the Red Sea issues, with the Panama Canal issues, with the Baltimore port recently on the East Coast, things like that change. So we've become quite a reactive, proactive model as well, because we're able to adapt to world changes all the time. So we plan. I'm literally before this podcast, I was looking at the rotations for 2025. We're fortunate this year. We've got the calendars already. But that's because the teams are looking now to have a little bit more regionalization and send from the last races to the first races rather than bring it back all the time. So, you know, there is a lot of change, and the planning is huge. Without answering for Georgia is really in the final mile end, let's say, the late freight, those urgent shipments, those crashes at the track that translate into spare part shipments, etc. And the planning of the race, you know, there at the track side. So she gets all the frustrated, the stressed teams screaming for instant delivery and service and reaction to problems. So I think Georgia's side is less in the planning. It's more.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, to be honest, you can plan as much as you want, but then you always have to find a solution, because, I mean, it will never go as you planned it. So you get used to always having a reaction to everything that has happened and is happening, because in a way, I mean, you can plan, but then you never know the outcome of the race. You never know if they're going to have crashes. So there's only as much that you can plan in advance. You cannot plan a crash. Of course, no one wants one, but then you have to react to it. So there is an amount of plan you can work on, but also a reaction as well to what happens on the race weekend.
So actually a quick follow-up there for you then, Georgia. So what does happen when a team crashes? For example, we know the whole thing that's been happening with Williams not having a spare chassis, having to move their cars back and forth around the world. Who gets that phone call? Is it you working directly with a team? How are you dealing with that when it happens?
Yeah, it will be me. So I will get that phone call asking to book extra space back to the UK or Italy or Germany or, I don't know, Switzerland. So in a way, I mean, what I like to say is I am a logistics fan. I am not really a Formula One fan. It has grown in the years. I don't mind it. But initially I was told you have to watch the race because you have to see what happens. If they crash, you have to be ready. So you have to watch it because of that. Now, and I mean, in a way I still do. I keep an eye on it. I don't watch the whole race, I have to be honest. I keep an eye on it. But the main reason is we have to watch it because we then can react we can react quicker to what happens. So we need to be aware of anything that is happening to react to it. So that is our main job on the Sunday. We watch the race to make sure we can cover any crash, basically.
Insane.
That's wild. Would you say you're more or less of a Formula One fan than when you started in 2018?
well, I know more, of course.
diplomatic way to put it.
Yeah. I enjoy the first lap and the last lap for sure. They are my favorites. In between,
don't we all?
In between, I like to use the time to catch up on anything else I haven't been able to, because it's the only moment we actually get with, in a way, no one coming to the office,
yeah,
to ask us questions. Yeah. Because of course they're all busy, so no one is in our office. We have time to focus on what we need to do for the after the race. So I like to use that time for my planning of after the race, whilst I still keep an eye on the TV.
rare moment of
Georgia. Peace. Georgia started in 2018, and obviously we had the pandemic in 2020.
Right.
So yeah. She had two really tough years, I have to say, out there. So exceptional.
Tiggy and I always joke that the best part of any race weekend is when the actual race happens, because that's when the least amount of work has to be done. You can finally relax.
That's true.
Yeah.
Until you get a phone call from whatever team.
Exactly.
So, Paul, you were mentioning the 2025 F1 calendar and planning for that. I know that was just announced to the public. So talk us through a little bit about how DHL plans logistics with teams. Like, what are the sort of decisions that need to happen now for 2025, for example?
Well, that's another area that's changed. I mean, it used to be cost-driven. It is cost-driven because of the cost cap. It still is very much probably priority one is risk-driven. You can't take risks with the cargo. You can't cut it too fine because the race is going to happen regardless. So that equipment has to be there. But more importantly now in that mix is sustainability. So we have three sort of challenges or requirements to meet to fit with the teams. Now they have sea freight equipment, five sets, six sets and seven sets, some depending on the team. And that goes in rotation around the world in the background by sea, which is a sustainable way of doing it, but it also allows us to move the lower value bulk items ahead of the race. So that would be the first arrival in Europe. Obviously, it's totally out of that. This is the international legs only.
Mm-hmm.
So they'll have five sets interacting. So, you know, the first part we have to look at what's obtainable within the schedule of a vessel. You know, there's limitations and parameters we have to work in by the speed of vessels, the routes, how well they're serviced. Outbound from China is serviced a lot because they manufacture a lot, so we've got a lot more options. So then we try and pencil all that together and then look, okay, what can't be sea freighted is then into the air freight modes. And that's normally the high-tech, last-minute, you know, cutting edge designs of the designers with the car, the carbon, the cars, the technology behind that. And that travels race to race because it's too expensive to replicate. But they also need the data from that equipment in the next race because it's valuable. So there's obviously air freight's a lot more expensive. We're moving even into the different modes on and reviewing the sustainable output on air freight. We've moved over the last 5 years from 747s to 777s, which is more sustainable. We're working with companies and looking at new technologies in marine. And in Europe, we're doing biofuel trucks. So as I say, the three parameters of making those decisions within the calendar, you know, there is a solution. We've just got to find the best one that fits and ticks all of those boxes.
Do you feel like when you're finding that solution, it ends up becoming a little bit more team specific? Like you mentioned at the beginning, some teams will have more packages than others, or do you try to sort of like standardize it across all of the teams and then work?
Which we tried to standardize it, but all teams are individuals, and even their location, like the Italian teams or the Swiss team that Georgia mentioned, they have different transit times because they're closer to the Suez, they're closer to some events, and further for some areas in the US or Canada, etc. So, or Mexico, we have a particularly quick transit from UK for Mexico. So every team has to be dealt different because of location and need and size and want. You know, every individual wants to be the first one to do something different, and unfortunately that pushes our logistics envelope to the max normally, and if it's achieved and the risk wasn't there, that not quickly becomes the norm for the following year. So sometimes going, you know, doing the impossible today becomes a normal tomorrow for the teams. But that's the business they're in, right? They're there to find 1/1000th of a second of a car on a track. So their brains and their gearing is all to push that boundary.
And when you think about that and with the sustainability lens, everyone's trying to push the envelope, go faster, move farther, do all the different things. How are you balancing that with maybe some demands from the teams and trying to weigh also your sustainability goals that you've set out to have?
Well, the you know, we're limited to technology as well, that's, and infrastructure. You know, what's available in Europe or US, for example, may not be available in Azerbaijan when I talk about different types of fuel. So we've got a kind of one atmosphere approach. So we try and offset that using our system and our aircraft around the world to give a carbon efficiency. The cost at the moment is a difficult subject because you've got cost cap, but these technologies and these alternative fuels are more expensive. You know, sustainability, unfortunately, at this point, until it's mass produced, it comes at a cost. So sometimes it's conflicting arguments, but the teams generally do go for the advice of the greener solution if it's, again, doesn't create any risk to the event.
Yeah, no, that's great to hear. And Georgia, probably a question for you. So when you're at the track on a given weekend, first of all, when do you arrive? Do you arrive much earlier than the teams arrive? And sort of at what point do things get handed off to the teams? How do you support them trackside? Maybe it depends on races, but very curious about that part of it.
So in the international, we always arrive the week before. So for example, in Miami, the race is next weekend on the 5th of May. Our team arrived on Monday, the 22nd of April. So average, we've got people on site for one single event, approximately 20 days. Because of course we work the week before, the week of the race and the week after. Europe is a bit different. We could say maybe average 8 to 10 days in a back-to-back. It's a bit less, but we are there before and we leave after everyone else. Ideally, the teams are normally on site from the Saturday, the week before, so everything has to be ready before they arrive. We've got until Wednesday to finalize everything with them if needed. Example, in Paddock Club, for example, tires. It is all done when they are on site too, but then, we're only... we don't have much time left, actually. It is all done in advance and afterwards.
And so how many people do you usually have at a race? Since, you know, you have to be there for so long, you're traveling all around the world. And I guess when you have double headers, you have to employ a lot more people to be a lot of different places at once.
Yeah, in the international, we've got approximately 20 people.
Wow.
In Europe, a bit more. I think we can double it. Because of course we have got many more truck drivers in a back to back. Also, we need more people. So in Europe, we go from 40 to 50, sometimes even more.
Wow!
So we've got 100 dedicated motorsport specialists in our team across Germany, Italy, and UK. And what George is saying is 20 is at the live event, let's say, but we'll have people going ahead for the sea freight inbound especially on back to backs, and you'll have another sea freight team mopping up the previous event. You've got to remember their venues. So they book a lot of events, not just F1, except for street races. So sometimes we're on strict curfews to get everything packed and out of there. Wow. So.
You never know when Taylor Swift will be coming to the arena next, right after the race.
So F1 is such a global sport. And just thinking about this is kind of mind-boggling. And Paul, earlier you were mentioning, you know, things like the Red Sea, things like Baltimore. How do you, when these global events are happening, is DHL working closely with international governments, even things like customs? How does that work, and how do you guys touch governments?
DHL as a company, as a product, it's called Resilience, and that's more for supply chain, but we do lean on it. So they'll look at all world events and they'll see how that impacts supply chain. So we'll get early heads up that these things are, not only the events happen, like Baltimore, you see on the news live, but no one really thinks about the trickle events. So all of those vessels got diverted, all of those sea freight containers got offloaded in the wrong places. So we get sight of that, and we get sight of clogged ports, congested ports, etc. So we can try and use that info to navigate it the best. obviously it's stressful because, you know, that's coming in and you've got to find a solution. And I've been told that about our team, you know, when everyone's still digesting the problem, our team's already in solution mode. And that probably is a training thing because we've done it for so long and are drilled in that way.
Incredible. Yeah, no, I can't even imagine what goes into working with all of the different governments and staying ahead of events. But huge kudos to you because it seems like every race weekend, everything's there since.
Yeah.
It looks very smooth from the fan perspective.
37 years after my watch, I'm not okay. No, but it has. I mean, we've had some scary moments. And when you said about government agencies, obviously they're huge events to the country as well. And totally. Especially if it's a government hosted event, because they're looking to increase tourism or whatever the rationale is for bringing that spotlight to their area of the world. So we do get, it's not a fast track. It's, you know, it's compliant the way customs are done in those countries, but we do get some good focus within the ministries to get certain approvals, fuel, certain products needed, fuel, food stuff, consumables. So we do get some dispensations for the event only. So we do work closely with them. But, you know, world events like the Baltimore or the Typhoon or whatever it is, that's out of everyone's control.
Yeah, exactly.
In business, they say you can have better, cheaper, or faster, but you only get to pick two. What if you could have all three at the same time? That's exactly what Cohere, Thomson Reuters, and Specialized Bikes have since they upgraded to the next generation of the cloud, Oracle Cloud Infrastructure. OCI is the blazing fast platform for your infrastructure, database, application development, and AI needs, where you can run any workload in a high availability, consistently high performance environment, and spend less than you would with other clouds. How is it faster? OCI's block storage gives you more operations per second. Cheaper? OCI costs up to 50% less for compute, 70% less for storage, and 80% less for networking. Better? In test after test, OCI customers report lower latency and higher bandwidth versus other clouds. This is the cloud built for AI and all your biggest workloads. Right now, with zero commitment, try OCI for free. Head to oracle.com/paddock. That's oracle.com/paddock.
Finding great candidates to hire can be like, well, trying to find a needle in a haystack. Sure, you can post your job to some job board, but then all you can do is hope the right person comes along. Which is why you should try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them for you. Its powerful technology identifies people with the right experience and actively invites them to apply to your job. You get qualified candidates fast. So while other companies might deliver a lot of hay, ZipRecruiter finds you what you're looking for. The needle in the haystack.
See why 4 out of 5 employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free, at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. That's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter.com/zip.
So shifting gears a little bit to sustainability, we talked briefly at the beginning about regionalization, co-localization of races. How much of that, I mean, I'm sure a large part of that is just driven by how much easier it is logistically. And of course, the sustainable impact of having to move less things back and forth around the world. How much is DHL involved in those conversations when it comes to the race regionalization?
I'd say, I won't speak up. Give Georgia a chance to speak, but I would say that's probably one of our most important topics at the moment. It's threaded within everything we do. And that's absolutely true. From being not considered, because we were already breaking land speed records to get freight where we were getting it in the time zones, to then put another layer on top of that of what we've got to consider all the way through. But, you know, I think, you know, we're achieving the sustainable goals within the infrastructure and the what's allowed to us around the globe, extraordinary. But it's an absolutely head topic at the moment, which is the right thing, I think.
Definitely. And how about Australia being the season opener next year? Does that change how you think about things? Is it going to be more of a challenge? Is it better?
Depends where the test is before that, if I have to say an honest appraisal of that question. But I mean, Australia's always been a sort of standalone. It's out there on its own. It takes 42 days to get to. And doesn't matter where in the calendar that is, that's a difficult. But then we'll thread it in. So we'll use that equipment. We'll be backdropped and held in Singapore. So that regionalization part is playing a big part. There's some natural regions with the US having four races, Middle East having four races, and Asia having the rest. So that helps us to navigate it and not bring them back. And the biggest question, or the biggest, you know, there's some quick wins by changing to, you know, sustainable fuels and et cetera. But I think mindset is a really difficult change. People have done it this way for a long time. So then to try and get them to change the way they think about it. For example, after every race season, they will have brand change and there's possible color changes to the car. There's a sponsor change, et cetera. So they want to overhaul the kit. In the UK, in their factories, because it's set for that. They've got all the suppliers here. But, you know, we put it to them that, you know, they are moving home basically to fix their TV in some cases. So you just send a TV, don't send the whole home. And when you simplify it like that to a team, they kind of go, yeah, okay, there may be stuff that we could do together where we can hold stuff out longer and from season to season. Obviously, there's safety elements that have got to be tested. You know, you can't do that with certain parts of the car. They need to come back and be recalibrated. So.
Yeah. So Ferrari's blue chassis for Miami, hopefully they're just sending over the paint.
Exactly.
So you mentioned sustainable fuel. I know DHL has been pioneering the biofuel trucks and other things, different green technologies and initiatives like sustainable motorhomes, fuel efficient aircraft, the biofuel trucks that we mentioned. Tell us more about those initiatives and kind of why they're so important to helping F1 and helping DHL get to net zero.
Well, DHL share that kind of philosophy. We have a 2050 net zero and F1 have a 2030 net zero. So anything we can do with F1 that ends up accelerating our overall goal as a company, then that's just a good thing. We have explored on the road the biofuel, and that was a great success, 83% reduction. And then we're turning to marine recently. And the aviation part, although it's a sustainable reduction, we will look eventually at sustainable aviation fuel. And as a company, we have and do run our fleet with sustainable aviation fuel. But by switching from a 747 model to a 777, it was a 17% saving thereabouts. So we've gone for a 5-year transition of the specialized cases that the teams use. Okay, the track shacks is the name that they go by at the circuit, but they're glorified sheds with a front door and they fill everything up. Okay, everything has its space, it's well protected, but so they've been modeled to go on a 777. So that transition has been happening in the background for 4 or 5 years. So everyone's seeing the final mile, let's say, this has been a topic that's been going on for quite a long while.
So speaking of final mile and these biofuel trucks, I know you've increased your fleet size this year up to 37, and they have great reduction in carbon footprint up to 83%. Do you think you'd ever move some of those biofuel trucks or try to expand the fleet maybe to the US or internationally as well as you're trying to, you know, greenify the entire footprint?
Yes, would be the obvious answer, but there is boundaries of possibility of where HVO biofuel is available, the type of trucks that are available in these countries. They're not all as advanced as we have here. We've seen in China, in India, you know, they're way behind that curve. So as it's available, for sure, and we're working with some partners now to look at that final mile part to see as a collective that we can provide that. And then exploring things like rail. So if Miami to Canada, we're either going to go rail or short sea and not road. So they're all things we're committing to, you know, again, within possibility, because if the Baltimore reposition of containers means that the rail is all clogged, it's an impossibility. So our intent is there, as I say, but we can only work within the limits that we've got.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And we know DHL, you guys are pioneering so many unique initiatives with F1 to achieve sustainability goals, but I know DHL is, you know, operates beyond just motorsport. What of these initiatives or technologies excites you most kind of regarding the broader applications in the logistics industry?
I think AI has huge potential. Hmm. If I have to call one out, as a because of the planning and the auditing and the checking and then the trace in today is a very human driven industry, I would say, certainly in a freight forwarding arena like ours. Express mm-hmm. is a little bit more automated already, the courier, the package, because there's so many, it has to be. But in a specialized area, it is quite a manual service at the moment, and I can see that being automated, which would hopefully de-risk a lot and certainly flag up the problems as they happen live, so, or recognize the problem. Today it would be picked up by a human who would, you know, then flag this problem, which we need that, as I say. So AI, route assessments, utilization, all of that good stuff that probably isn't being explored today. Don't send trucks half empty, don't send the aircraft half empty, yeah. don't send yeah. boats half empty, yeah. All of that good stuff. So I think AI will help with that. But obviously that's got to be married with the sustainable fuels, et cetera, as well to complete that circle.
Totally. And Georgia, I guess for you on the ground, when it comes to sustainability, I know we're talking a lot about logistics kind of pre-race or getting to the race. Do you see any of that on the ground in terms of affecting the sustainability at races?
It is getting better, I have to say. From my very first year, I was a bit, I've always been worried about the situation. Now, year after year, it's getting better. We have got recycling bins at the track. So they are trying to make sure everyone is into it. And it is improving year after year. Still, it depends on the circuits, most of all. Mm-hmm. I mean, we can only do our best, but then it has to come from the local promoter and people as well, because if we don't get given the equipment in a way, we cannot do much. So I have to say it is mainly driven by the local people as well. Then we adapt to it, of course, but it's not only in our control when it comes to be like an on-site mm-hmm. an on-site action.
Yeah, that's such a great point. And Tiggy and I talk about this basically in every aspect of Formula One. It's incredibly unique, the connection and reliability to those local providers, promoters, etc., to really get the whole weekend done and done correctly. So that is an incredibly good point, one that we hear a lot. Okay, so we've had such a fun time talking about sustainability and logistics. One thing that we always like to do at the end of our episodes, which is kind of like our own little fun thing for guests, is just do a few rapid fire questions. They're easy, but just you have to tell us what you think right off the top of your head. So
this is true.
I'll ask one question. You guys can both answer, and then Tiggy will ask one. They're easy.
They're easy.
So don't worry. okay, so your favorite race that you've been to?
Japan.
Japan.
Georgia?
It's a difficult one because I don't know if I have
quick round.
Yeah, no, but I think I would say Japan too, but I have to explain why.
Yes.
Please do.
Because it's my favorite, one of my favorite, not the only one, but it's the only one country we go to where you actually feel like you are abroad. Yes. You just feel in a different country and you adapt to their own culture. You don't you have to adapt, and it's the only one place in the world where I feel like I am abroad.
Wow, that's wild, especially given how many countries you've been to.
Yeah.
My rationale is exactly the same, with the added 37 years ago I started, and the relationship I had was with Honda Engines. And they were supplying McLaren and Williams, etc. at the time. So that was the Ayrton Senna Prost period. And I got asked by Honda as a thank you to go to their factory. So that was the very first long-haul country outside of Europe that I'd ever visited. So it's a kind of soft spot for me, I guess, the country.
That's incredible. And Honda's continuing their Formula One journey,
yes,
which is super exciting.
Yes, they are. They're back again.
Exactly. Okay, last one, hopefully easy. And Georgia, maybe this is difficult for you given how often you move around the world, but best hometown recommendation. So I guess, Paul, if that's London for you, Georgia in Italy or elsewhere, whether that's a restaurant, a park, a museum, a hike, anything.
Portobello Market, London.
Yes.
Oh, so good.
Such a good one. We love that.
Well, I'm Italian and I can only but mention Bologna and the food that we have in the area, in the region.
Yeah, I'm English. I can't mention the food.
It's getting better. London is getting better.
Apparently. Yeah, we copy everyone else's.
It's okay. Sometimes you have to steal to be great. Georgia, do you have a restaurant recommendation in Bologna?
I love the cappelletti. Again, in Bologna, they call them differently. So they would be called tortellini. Sfogliarino, which is an actual fresh pasta place where you can you can eat fresh pasta every day.
Amazing.
I'm starving now. Well, thank you both so much. This has been such a pleasure, and we really appreciate the time and learning more about logistics and DHL and sustainability more broadly. So really appreciate it. And Georgia, safe travels to and Paul to Miami.
We may see you there. Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.